From Utah to West Virginia, South Carolina to California, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, for the first time in history, this year, the nation's population will shrink. A lack of housing is a contributing factor. Emily Hamilton from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to explain. The longest federal government shutdown in history has come to an end, but did it accomplish anything? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Oliver Dunford of the Pacific Legal Foundation about one of the key elements of presidential tariff powers now before the Supreme Court. And affordability was an issue in this month's general elections. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary on how states are dealing with the problem. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Housing is in the spotlight as President Donald Trump proposes a 50-year mortgage in an effort to make home ownership more affordable. But other factors are keeping buyers out of the market. Emily Hamilton is a senior research fellow and director of the Urbanity Project at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She is here to discuss. Emily, welcome to American Radio Journal. Emily, we're going to talk about housing affordability, how that's impacting population growth, and just overall affordability. Before we get into that, though, President Trump this past week proposed a 50-year mortgage. Now, right now, 30-year mortgages are about the extent of how long you can take to pay for a home. Just your thoughts on the idea of expanding that to 50 years. A good idea? Not a good idea?
Thanks for having me, Loman. Well, I would say that the president was about right when he said in a press conference that it wouldn't have a huge effect. I'm not opposed to the idea of a 50-year mortgage in principle. If lenders wanted to offer that and borrowers wanted to take advantage, but it does nothing to address the regulations that are in many markets fixing the amount of housing that can be provided. We need more housing for more different types of households at a wider variety of price points. And the finance does not address the zoning rules and other regulations that are just making it impossible to deliver that housing in many parts of the country.
Let's talk a bit about those housing rules and regulations, et cetera. A lot of that devolves to local or municipal government, Emily. Now, I had the opportunity for a number of years to serve as chairman of a board of supervisors in a very large municipality. And every time a housing development was proposed, there was significant public pushback about it, not wanting more traffic, et cetera, et cetera. How is all that impacting the supply of housing that we have?
It's constrained it drastically in lots of places. Many people like their neighborhoods the way they are right now for lots of understandable reasons. They don't want more cars on their streets. They don't want to lose any tree cover, don't want more kids going to their kids' schools. But when these attitudes are codified in public policy and repeated place after place, we end up with a situation where in many of the areas where our country's best job opportunity, not enough homes for all the people who would like to move to those places to take advantage of those opportunities.
And without this new construction, how does that impact those who are trying to get into home ownership for the first time?
We're seeing that the average age of new ownership reached 40 years old, an all-time high in the data that we have available. And it's not just in home ownership that these issues are showing up. We also see that a record number of adults over 25 years old are still living with their parents. So in some cases, that's a happy situation, but in many cases, it reflects adults not being able to move out and start lives and families of their own.
Looking at that part of the equation then, is this preventing family formation to the point where it's impacting our overall population growth?
Yes, this concerning trend in housing affordability and ownership is also being met with people having fewer children than ever in the U.S. And one factor driving people to have fewer children than they might like to is this delay that people are having in being able to move out, establish their careers and the location where that career may be located, and afford housing, whether it's rental or home ownership of their own.
There usually is a drive for single-family homes. They seem to be something that there's less public resistance to. But Emily, at the end of the day, is multifamily housing units, townhouses, duplexes, doubles, whatever you want to call them, is that part of the solution?
Absolutely. Zoning has, A, limited all types of housing. So we have an undersupply of single-family housing as well as less expensive types of housing. But local regulations generally do the most to prevent the construction of the least expensive types of housing, whether that's small apartments, manufactured housing, as you mentioned, or single-family homes on very small lots that allow people to economize on land. And so when we cut out these lower cost housing options, it makes it a big leap to move from something like your parents' home or your college into another housing option that will be within reach given your budget. And so people end up stuck in places where they would not be living, unable to pursue their own best opportunities, whether that's in a career or in their social lives. And it's leading to fewer people getting married, fewer people having kids.
What impact are the current level of interest rates having on this? They're nowhere near an all-time high, but they're higher than what we have seen in recent decades. Is it necessary for the interest rates to come down for housing affordability to go up?
They're definitely related. There's no doubt that nationwide factors and the pandemic surges in demand for housing have contributed to across the country, but we still see huge variation across localities. In spite of higher interest rates, some localities are seeing higher rates of housing permitting than others, indicating that interest rates aren't shutting off new housing supply everywhere. Where the permit approval process takes a lot of time, sitting on a high interest rate construction loan, interest rates are going to do more to reduce new housing construction in those markets where permit approval processes take a really long time.
We have been talking with Emily Hamilton, who is Senior Research Fellow and Director of the Urbanity Project at the Mercatus Center, located at George Mason University. Emily, tell us a little bit about George Mason University and the Mercatus Center.
George Mason is in Northern Virginia. It's where I got my PhD in economics. And here at the Mercatus Center, we study lots of different facts, including this work on housing regulations. And you can find all of our research on housing policy and many other topics at mercatus.org.
Emily Hamilton of the Mercatus Center. Emily, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Loman. Great talking with you.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth in Washington, D.C., which the federal government is now reopened and, I guess, for the most part, operating. Scott, good to have you here.
It's my pleasure, Loman.
President Donald Trump signed the bill that reopens the federal government at least through the end of January. Your thoughts, Scott, on whether it was all worth it?
Well, I think that the Schumer shutdown is one of those instances where enough Senate Democrats came to their senses and said, you know what, the airport delays, the SNAP benefits, just the optics of us filibustering the Republicans who had passed a bill through the House, this isn't really going to work. They had 14 votes that the Democrats blocked. And on the 15th time, it was sort of the 15th time is a charm. We had 8 Senate Democrats join 52 of the Senate Republicans to end the filibuster and ultimately to reopen the government. That bill did include a provision that will rehire those reductions in forces, the federal workers that were laid off during the shutdown, but that only accounts to about 4,000 federal workers, which kind of pales in comparison to the overall amount that we saw from Doge, and I think it was about 150,000 federal workers that were laid off through different efficiencies from USAID and other agencies. The bill passed through the House of Representatives. You had six House Democrats join most of the House Republicans. I think there were two House Republicans that voted against the bill. But, you know, ultimately, the Schumer shutdown did come to an end. I think it's a big win for President Trump and those congressional Republicans because ultimately they never caved on those Biden-era COVID subsidies, an enhancement of Obamacare that Biden jammed through during a crisis that we had with COVID. However, the Democrats want to try to extend those and make it a political issue for 2026.
Taking a look at those subsidies that are going to be expiring here, Scott, I think it's important to note that the expiration date is in place because every Democrat in the House and Senate at the time voted to put it in place. So they are expiring because that's what Democrats plan to do. But this is going to become a political issue, and Republicans are going to need to be providing some alternatives. Are any alternative ideas starting to perk to the surface?
Well, I think there are. I think we first need to go back all the way to 2009 when Barack Obama was elected president. And in 2009 and 2010, they ushered through Obamacare. At the time, the average family of four paid about $13,000 for their health insurance premiums. That has more than doubled in the year of 2025. It's all the way up to $27,000 for the average family of four nationally. And then when you add in the premium increases that we're going through right now, health insurance is really becoming a tough thing for not just average households, but also for employers that help with employee-sponsored health insurance. I think that Republicans need to look at these subsidies and understand that they are direct payments to the health insurance companies that are currently incurring the largest profits they've ever had. And obviously, as a free market organization, we want health insurance companies to be profitable. But the problem in this case here is that choice and competition in the health insurance marketplace has been completely uprooted by the Democrats who are trying to lunge us toward this socialist single health payer healthcare system that would be closer to a Medicare for all system. And so the regulatory pillars of Obamacare, when you think about what's known as community rating, where everybody in a community is priced together for their risk assessment, and then also the guaranteed coverage, the pre-existing condition coverage mandates that exist in Obamacare, that causes premiums to increase. So you need to think about how do we increase choice? How do we increase competition? We need to have price transparency in health insurance. We need to make sure that we expand the ability for health savings accounts. We need to deregulate the insurance marketplace. And instead of having that federal promise of pre-X, we should do what the states have done that's been successful. We should have high-risk pools in the states that maybe are funded through the federal government, but they separate out that unhealthy population that is currently being subsidized by healthy folks. And overall, I think is breaking the insurance system to cover people. President Trump said, hey, these subsidies are going directly to the health insurers. We need to make sure that we get the money to the people and then help them purchase health insurance. I think that'll be an idea that also gets flushed out between now and whenever they hold that vote in December. You know, this is just a promise. It's not a promise that Republicans are going to vote for an extension of the subsidies, but they did promise the Democrats that they would hold a vote on that issue. The subsidies expire at the end of 2025. We're already in open enrollment at the beginning of November, and that ends in the middle of December. So obviously health insurance and affordability is one of the big crises facing America, along with their housing crisis.
Speaking of affordability, do you think it was as big of an issue in the recent general elections as what some of the Democrats are saying it was?
I think it's certainly a contributing factor because the young generation right now, the folks that are in their 20s, they're not having access to high-paying jobs, and they're certainly not having access to the housing market when you have mortgage interest rates that exceed 7%. And historically, that's not the highest that we've ever faced. But when you were purchasing a home for $100,000 in 1975, that buying power today is $550,000 through inflation. What's causing the inflation? It's our debt and deficit situation and just the big government that the Democrats, I think, have been largely responsible for ushering through whenever they've had the opportunity to do so.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. Our group is United in Economic Freedom and Opportunity and Liberty. If you want to learn more about us, you can visit clubforgrowth.org, where you can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
The Supreme Court of the United States is pondering the tariff powers of the president. With a look at one of the major issues under consideration, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Oliver Dunford of the Pacific Legal Foundation.
President Donald Trump's tariff regime went in front of the U.S. Supreme Court last week. It was a more than 3 hour long oral argument. There were obviously a lot of legal and constitutional issues thrown around, but one of them really stood out to me. This is the so-called major questions doctrine. It will be really important, I think, in resolving the tariff case, but honestly, it's really important to a lot of other legal issues that go in front of the Supreme Court. And that's what we're going to take a closer look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Oliver Dunford. He is a senior attorney, at the Pacific Legal Foundation. He joins us now on the phone to chat about the tariff case and the major questions doctrine. Oliver, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Yeah, appreciate it, Eric. Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Let's start with, I imagine most people in their day-to-day lives don't encounter the major questions doctrine often. Can you give me a quick, concise definition of what it is?
What's called a canon of construction or interpretation. Basically, it's a way for the court to determine what a statute means. And there are other examples of this. One is the rule of lenity, which applies to criminal statutes. And it says if there's a question about what the statute means, you're going to, in those cases, you're going to side with the defendant, not with the government. This one is similar. It says that if the government claims a really broad power out of a statute that is not so clear, then the benefit or the rule of presumption should be against that exercise of power. And so what the court says in cases of major economic or political instances, Congress has to speak clearly to authorize the government's action.
So it is, as you said there, it's basically the equivalent of innocent until proven guilty. But when you're talking about does Congress or the executive have this power, it's got to be Congress has the power unless proven that the executive does, more or less.
Yeah, or did Congress authorize this kind of power at all? Did it adopt the sweeping power that the government claims?
Yeah, now that's come up obviously quite a bit in the lower court cases and now in the Supreme Court case taking a look at the tariff powers. The president has claimed under this emergency economic law from the 1970s that he's allowed to impose tariffs. What did you hear at the oral arguments? Justice Gorsuch in particular, Roberts got in on this too, but there was a bunch of questions directed at both the challengers and the government over exactly how the court should take the major questions doctrine and apply it in this case.
Yeah, and you mentioned Gorsuch and Roberts, but Justice Sotomayor asked a number of good questions on that topic, too. And the reason is that the statute says that the president may regulate the importation of products, and the government argues that that includes the power to impose tariffs. And one argument raised by the government is that the major questions doctrine should not apply to foreign policy questions. That's where the president is supposedly at his most powerful. He can do things mostly unreviewable. The problem for that argument is that the Constitution vests the power over tariffs to Congress. And so the question is, did Congress authorize the president to make these kinds of sweeping tariff rules? The challengers say that that kind of imprecise language under the major questions doctrine is not enough to give the president this sweeping power over tariffs.
We're chatting with Oliver Dunford. He's a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, chatting about last week's big, very important Supreme Court hearing on President Donald Trump's tariffs, a case that I think has some big implications, obviously, for the tariffs, but also for just the very structure of government, executive power, separation of powers, all of these things kind of hanging in the balance here, Oliver. Obviously, major questions has come up a lot in front of the court recently. I'm thinking like the Biden student loan decision from a few years ago, and the sort of there's the possibility here, I guess, of other important cases that will be resolved along these same lines going forward. This is not a one-off, basically. How do you see this being part of a trend here of the court taking more seriously this question of when Congress has power versus when the executive does?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that this is a major question. So the dispute, as you mentioned before, is whether this major questions doctrine can apply to the foreign policy or a policy that involves some foreign affairs aspects. And one other part about this doctrine is the Chief Justice is largely supportive of it. This is a pure guess, but in a case like this, when you're talking about the president's powers and such a vast assumption of powers, my gut says that the chief wants to write this opinion. And so I wonder if he can, for that reason alone, he wants to say, yes, the major questions doctrine applies. He can get Justice Gorsuch and then the three progressives on the court. So that's kind of my prediction, but I could easily see it going the other way.
And for somebody like you, Oliver, and for people at PLF who are bringing these sorts of constitutional questions in front of courts, including the Supreme Court, all the time, I mean, how do you want to see this influence future decisions and the ongoing jurisprudence of the country?
Yeah, one thing I hope comes from this, aside from the major questions doctrine, is just a very close look at statutory language. There is a slew of statutes in the United States Code that do give the president powers over statutes. He can adjust the rates in certain instances. And this statute, the IEEPA, is an emergency statute. It doesn't say tariff or anything like that. And so in this instance especially, it would be challenging for the court to say that in an unclear statute with contrary examples all over the place, that this gives the president this kind of sweeping power. And I do hope that once the case is over, that people realize that executive agencies and the president carry out arbitrary actions all the time. And this is getting a lot of attention, but individuals and small businesses that we represent face these kinds of arbitrary actions. And of course, it costs them a lot more than it does the big companies who can more afford to maneuver through DC and pay the cost of the regulations.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And obviously, the major questions doctrine kind of being resurrected as a major element of what the Supreme Court looks at in these types of cases is good news for Americans who want to see federal power and executive power curtailed and limited and kept to its proper constitutional space. We're unfortunately out of time for today, but great conversation, Oliver. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
Once again, that is Oliver Dunford. He's a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. You can check out their fine work on a variety of legal and constitutional issues. They have a bunch of ongoing cases. Check all of that out at pacificlegal.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bame. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
States across the nation are taking steps to address the high cost of living. We get details from Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
When James Carville coined the phrase, "It's the economy, stupid," during Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign for president, he captured a truism of American politics. Americans vote with their pocketbooks. And now with the 2025 elections in the rearview mirror, results in New York City deserve some additional attention, as the cost of living is the ultimate pocketbook issue, and those costs are astronomical in places like the Big Apple. Self-described democratic socialist Zohran Mamdani has been elected mayor. But what was the general theme of his well-funded campaign? Ironically, in a word, affordability. His campaign promised a rent freeze for housing costs and government-run grocery stores to lower food costs. For New Yorkers burdened by record rents and taxes, it sure sounded like relief. Yet economics isn't about good intentions. It's about trade-offs and actual outcomes. Affordability does not come from price controls in the long term. Any student of history knows that price controls lead to scarcity or other deferred consequences. Plans with slogans like freeze the rent or cap prices have a seductive simplicity. but over time, they destroy the very incentives that lead to more housing, more supply, and more competition. When landlords cannot charge market rents, fewer build supply or make improvements to their property. When grocers face price caps, shelves will empty out, or stores may shut down altogether. The very cure becomes the disease. Rent control in New York is hardly new. Decades of rent-controlled and rent-subsidized units exist, with lotteries determining who gets the subsidy. The lottery is a stark signal. When you must draw lots to find affordable housing, something is clearly broken. Markets can't function without price signals, we know. So when prices are artificially frozen by government, development is thwarted. When supply can't expand in response to demand, then prices don't moderate, they rise further. Development, of course, is the answer. When housing prices rise, the free market signal is to build more. That extra supply then moderates prices. But when you freeze prices and allow bureaucratic permitting rules and zoning laws to block new units, supply falls and demand remains, so then affordability goes out the window. Mr. Mamdani's agenda is not novel. It merely repeats the failures of the past. And while it may help a few in New York, it's going to leave most of New Yorkers left behind. The same philosophy is clearly visible in Washington, D.C., where Senate progressives insisted for weeks that reopening of government should be linked to protecting pandemic-era subsidies for Obamacare, or the so-called Affordable Care Act. It does beg the important question that if the Affordable Care Act was actually affordable, why are there even subsidies needed in the first place? When regulation, mandates, and government-distorted markets dominate, government kills competition and innovation. Property taxes, driven by sky-high assessments by local governments, directly reduce housing and affordability. It is no wonder why property tax burdens are near the top of problems taxpayers identify in nearly every state today. That's why the ALEC Model Truth in Taxation Act matters. In practice, that means that when property taxes rise, the tax rate should decline. Unless voters and elected officials explicitly approve more revenue through assessments. Utah, the state with the best economic outlook in America for 18 years running in rich states, poor states, the Truth in Taxation Law has been on the books since 1985 and has prevented many hidden tax hikes through assessment increases that brush affordability. Similarly, on energy affordability, the government's reach often drives up prices. ALEC's Energy Security ARC model, as recently adopted by Louisiana this year, addresses the need for affordable and reliable domestic energy supply. Americans are demanding an affordability and agenda, and rightly so, but the solutions will not come from grand government mandates, price freezes, or ever-growing subsidies from places like New York City or Washington, D.C. Real affordability comes when we restore the mechanisms that create wealth. Competition, innovation, individual choice, decentralization. So the lesson remains simple. It's still the economy, stupid. As Americans rightly demand an affordability agenda, let us not look to the failed promises of big government, but to free markets and ideas that empower individuals through the power of choice. For more information, you can visit ALEC.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WOND-AM and WBSS-AM in Linwood, New Jersey, along with WHAI-FM in Greenfield, Massachusetts. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.